Well, I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank Dennis and Kathy for giving me the opportunity to speak with you a little bit about our experience with bundled payments. There's been a lot, obviously, that I think all of us as health plans have had to deal with over the last 3 to 5 years, including Medicare and their BPCI program and their initiatives that they've had around bundled payments. And so there's been a lot out there. And what I learned when I got to Scott White is both that the system has dabbled with bundled payments, actually got involved in the BPCI initiative. They also did something with Walmart around doing a Centers of Excellence where they were doing joint replacement under a bundled payment. The health plan had not. So one of the things when I heard about some of this stuff and started talking with our system chief medical officer about what we could do more to partner with the system around some unique alternative payment models, this discussion kind of came up. So what you're going to see in the presentation over the next 45 minutes or so is really just sharing with you a little bit what the system experience was with BPCI, just some very high level stuff, and then what we launched into in connection with the health system and trying to follow that pattern to look at developing something for the system or for the health plan. Today, what the other thing you're going to hear is today we haven't implemented anything, but we're on our way to implement something, because I do think it's important for the health plan to get some experience in this area. And then one other thing that I want to touch on is Baylor, Scott and White has a big research arm as well as part of the system. And I had a discussion about 3 weeks ago with some of the physicians involved in some research around early detection of pancreatic cancer. And so during that discussion, we started talking about, through their assessment or their detection program that they wanted to implement, about doing some bundling around the assessment piece of what they're trying to do to learn and to study. And they're doing a research project with it, hoping to get some federal funding for this program. But the whole idea around it is to try to get better at early detection so that you can improve the survival rate. So if we have time from where this goes, I want to spend a little bit of time just sharing that with you. That's in our early stage, but it's a hybrid of what you consider a general bundle payment program, in that we're only looking at bundling an assessment program. The cost around treating pancreatic cancer is pretty wide and deep, so that would be hard to really do in a bundle. So let's get started with this. First thing is a little bit of advertisement on Scott White Health Plan, which you heard a little bit, I think, this morning. Lindsay, you probably talked about the Baylor Scott White system in totality. So I'm showing you a Texas map here of where the health plan service area is today. We continue to look at expansion and the development of our network across the state. But one of the reasons I wanted to show this to you as we get into the bundled payment, besides the number of hospital providers that we contract with in the 80 counties, I've learned in the Texas geography, they refer to something as the Texas Triangle. And Lindsay and Randall are very familiar with this, but the Texas Triangle really starts at the point, would be Dallas, and Fort Worth would be the point of the triangle. And then if you go southwest from Dallas, you run into San Antonio, and that would be the second point of the triangle. And then if you cut across the state, at the bottom there, you run into Houston, and that becomes the third point of the triangle. Then you go back up to Dallas. Fort Worth. They call that the Texas Triangle, and within that area, know, Texas is a big state, but just within that geographic area, the growth of the population within Texas, they are predicting, even as big a state as what Texas is, 75% of the population is going to reside within that triangle. So they expect a lot, you know, there's a lot of places that you can go up here, up into these white spaces where I think, Linda, you come in. They don't even have a doctor in a lot of these counties because there's maybe only three or four people that live in the county. But, and that's almost the truth. But in the Texas Triangle, you've got Dallas, Fort Worth, you've got San Antonio, you've got Houston, you also got this interesting little town that's been the fastest growing city in the country, I think, for the last three or four years, called Austin. And it's currently, right now, its MSA is about 2 million. It's anticipated it's going to grow to 4 million within the next 10 to 15 years. They have this I-35 corridor here, in which it's the main interstate that goes from Dallas down to all the way down to the Texas border, I believe. Is that correct, guys? It goes all the way down to the Texas border to Mexico. But growth and construction is happening all along there. So it's a fast-growing area. The total population within that area is expected to be somewhere in the range of about 25 to 30 million people over the next 10 years. So a lot of stuff going on there. A lot of opportunity for growth as well. This is the health plan. The health plan is currently number one with it. Rated within the Southwest market. Although I would say, while when I was looking at that with our group, they do some very good things at the health plan and they got some great scores. But when you look at Texas as a state, because of the high uninsured rate, a lot of immigrants in the state as well, when you look at quality ratings within the state relative to national averages, they are actually below the national average. So while it may be a good thing to say you're number one, when I compare Scott White to a lot of organizations in this room, as well as nationally, some of the better organizations, they still have a lot of work to do. Okay, so on, I called this bundle payment 2.0. The reason I did that is in 2012, and that would have been the year before the Baylor-Scott & White merger. The health plan tried to get more integrated with the Scott & White clinic and system into doing some payment models together. And because they, believe it or not, had been operating a little bit more isolated from each other. I mean, they had their capitation programs and they had certain things, but health plan did one thing, system did another. They didn't do a lot of integration. And so it was in 2012, some of the leaders took on the idea of, hey, let's maybe try to do a bundled payment with the system. A lot of it was around gaining experience. They had a good orthopedic department at Memorial, which is in Temple, which is the flagship hospital for Scott & White. And so they thought, hey, let's do a pilot around these. And they went out on the road to work with the department to try to set that up and to make that something that they could have some great experience with or learn from. And if it worked, then they planned on expanding it to other departments. And do other procedures. But as they got into it, they ran into a lot of problems, some headwinds, lack of support from across the system. I think anybody that has had experience in doing bundled payments, and I believe somebody's here from Geisinger. Somebody here from Geisinger? She just stepped out. So Geisinger could probably, for sure, because of a lot of the stuff they've done with their programs around bundled payments, could speak a lot to the importance of getting support across the system to make these type of programs work. And as you can see, because there wasn't buy-in, that first attempt really didn't go anywhere. And you can summarize it by saying the health system and health plan really weren't aligned in trying to make it happen. So didn't go anywhere. So then, fast forward to 2017, same reasons for doing it, trying to optimize value. The environment a little bit different, because now you have Baylor Scott and White merged in, or the merged system together. They've been merged since late 2013. They have been trying to integrate all the hospitals, the physicians, getting the health plan more involved in the activities for the system. And so they sought out to, or they had, a little bit more open mind about, hey, we ought to be looking and trying to do something. I think one of the first questions, I started at the health plan back in late April 2016. And one of the first questions I asked is why we hadn't done a bundled payment initiative. Because I would have thought, just thinking about Scott and White and Baylor and the integration, that this would have been a no-brainer. But they hadn't done it, so we said we really need to try to take some learning from this, because as we go forward, we know there are going to be a lot of opportunities to work with employers around the bundled payment. The other good thing that happened that wasn't there in 2012 was, obviously, CMS was out with their initiatives, and Baylor Scott & White was involved in the knees and hips VRG program around bundled payment, which we'll talk about in a second. Then went into, because of that pilot, went into a mandatory bundled payment program for certain geographies around the country. The other key thing was we did receive support from the Executive Vice President and the CMO of the Baylor Scott & White Health System. So they were supportive of the idea of making it happen. And so when you got senior leaders that are bought into it, I can tell you, for those of you who may not traverse this road yet or thought about doing it, getting this leadership on the provider side engaged and willing is critical, or it won't go anywhere. So let's talk a little bit about the challenges and the opportunities. First one I put on here was network composition between North Texas and Central Texas. They're vastly different. For those of you who know Texas, for those of you who don't, I'll share a little bit with you. Central Texas is a group model environment, very similar to the model I came out of in Illinois, where you have a multi-specialty group practice. It's a lot like Geisinger, probably a lot like some of the other plans in this room. You have a multi-specialty group practice. You have hospitals that are tightly integrated, so you have a lot. You have an administrative structure that manages the whole thing, and it works very efficiently. In North Texas, I refer to it as Medical Beirut. It's it is more the Wild Wild West. I mean, I don't know. Here's another good example, which is crazy. In Texas, you have these things called freestanding ERs. Mm-hmm. See people shaking their heads and heard of it. I don't know if those exist in any other states. There may be a few. But Texas is ground zero for freestanding ERs. There's no CON laws. You don't have to get approval. You could wake up one day, if you're the hospital CEO, and right across the street, a freestanding ER just popped up. And they charge ER rates, yep, thinking that they're just as good or better than the ERs that actually are part of a hospital. So that makes for a crazy environment. We do have a few of those in Central. We have freestanding ERs in Central Texas, but they're just a plethora of them up here in the Dallas, Fort Worth market. And makes it very challenging as you think about your networks and some of the coordination that you gotta do. Hardly anybody wants to contract with these freestanding VRs. No joke, you could go in there with a cold or a fever and come out with $1,000 bill. And most of them don't want to contract with the insurance companies because they have this silly thing called balance billing. Some of you may be familiar with that. So they just say the insurance companies don't pay them. And they're believing that, hey, we'll provide emergency services. Either the member will pressure the insurance company to get it paid, or the member is going to get stuck with it, and then the member is going to go complain about how terrible health care is and how bad the costs are. Yes, Kevin.
How do you handle that when those freestanding ERs are part of your owner system?
How do we handle it? They don't want to handle it. But I'm going to answer your question in a way that what Baylor has done, most of the systems look at them and say, and this would be somewhat true of our system, but most systems look at it and say, hey, they're not true emergency rooms. They shouldn't be allowed to do it. So there's I won't use the word animosity, but a lot of fear from the systems that's pulling stuff away from them that shouldn't go there, and then they end up having to then work on the train wrecks when these ERs don't really have the capability to manage them. So, Kathy, to your point, what Baylor Scott and White has done, what we've done as a health plan is the provider has looked at partnering with some of the freestanding ERs. In fact, they've created some joint ventures. Baylor's approach to it is that we don't want to be part of the organizations that have done freestanding ERs. We want to work. There was a company that came in and actually put together what they call an ER hospital. That's the way I can describe it. Emirates would be an example of that company, where they have 12 or 14 hospital beds to go with their unit. So they're a little bit more prepared to manage some of the cases that come in their door, where those that are just freestanding, don't have hospital beds attached to them. If something truly goes wrong, they're picking up the phone, asking for whatever hospital is close by to come, and send an ambulance over and then dump the patient at the hospital because the care just got too complex for them to be able to handle it on site. The health plan has been partnered with the joint venture company at Baylor has gotten involved in, but we stay away from partnering with some of these freestanding ERs unless they're willing to contract under our rules. And under our rules, what we've said is we're not paying your charges. We've gone through and we've looked at their visit patterns around what their diagnoses are, and we've identified about 50 to 65% of all their visits are really urgent care visits. So basically, we've come back and we've said, here's a fee schedule. So if you're willing to take this reimbursement for the urgent care visits that you get, you can be allowed to come into the network. But if you're not willing to take this fee schedule, then we're not going to contract with you because a lot of them want to charge ER rates for basically urgent type primary care visits. So that's how we handle it. But anyway, the other thing that's critical about the North Texas market is they're not a medical group centric market. It's a bunch of independent, individual, or hospital owned primary care, specialty groups that kind of carve themselves into single specialty businesses or practices. You've got cardiology, you got cardiovascular groups, you got orthopedic groups, you got ophthalmology groups, so it's fairly disjointed. So that creates challenges, and the reason I brought that up is that creates challenges because as you're trying to do these bundled joint payment programs, when you've got disjointed providers and networks, a little bit harder, or it's much harder, to corral everybody into a discussion around what's the cost of the procedure, how are we going to get everybody aligned, and then how are we going to then make the customer experience one that is satisfactory and creates that kind of experience that we want to get from the patient or the member. Health, you talked about health system commitment. And then ultimately what we create, or it's not going to work, is the value proposition. What's the value of doing this? Can you show to the provider that if we can reduce, one, can reduce some of the quality issues, infection rates, and some of that improved quality, improved consistency and cost, the provider will then see better performance in what they're providing to the patient, because the groups that are working together under the bundle are delivering a better outcome. When you deliver a better outcome, then you'll get more people wanting to use your services and use that program than the other programs that are around the community. So, get into a little bit of the other thing, I guess, let me back up. Another statement I wanted to make here for you is the other, it's both a challenge and an opportunity, but we also believe one of the reasons to do it is the market is eventually going to ask for it. I'm sure all of you may be able to, if you haven't, you will soon, be able to have experience where you've got either employers asking for it, your customers asking for these kind of programs. In Texas, we've already had, like I mentioned, Walmart, United Airlines, General Electric. They've all been employers who are specifically asking for these kind of programs. And surprisingly enough, you start to see some of the implant companies come around and say they'd like to participate and help with trying to get these programs together because they see the handwriting on the wall. So again, under the analysis points that we launched into, we were looking at DRGs 469 and 470. As you can read up here, those are the lower extremity joint replacement, both with major complications and comorbidities. We exclude ankles. This is in line. So our attempt in setting something up was to align that with the Medicare pilot program under BPCI, in which they did these same DRGs. And then they mandated the pilot. After they did the pilot, then they mandated this reimbursement. I think it included 791 hospitals in 67 geographic areas starting in April of 2016. The, I guess, good news, bad news on that is the Baylor Scott & White had some of their geographic areas were those that were included in the mandatory payment geographies. And we had Temple, which is where the health plan is located, and Round Rock. And some of you may not be familiar with Texas. Round Rock is what I'll call a community just about 20 miles south of Austin. You could basically say it's a suburb of Austin because Austin's growing out to Round Rock. And so Baylor had two hospitals in those markets that were going to be under this mandatory payment for Medicare under the bundled payment program. So they were right in the middle of realizing, okay, it's mandatory under Medicare, so we're going to be getting that experience. We ought to go ahead, work with the health plan and looking at it under a commercial basis and get some learning there. Because what you do in Medicare, while there are similar ways we go about looking at the results here, developing the data points and putting it together, what you do under the commercial side is going to be a little bit different than you do under the Medicare population because they're a different population. And how do you pull it together? From a technical standpoint, we were looking at our commercial population of roughly 87,000 members. Ultimately, what you're going to see here, too, is that the health plan also administers the Baylor Scott & White employee program. That's another 68,000 that gets added to the mix. So we actually looked at the experience when it was all said and done, and not only our commercial population, but our employee population as well. And I'll get to the reason for why we looked at it. Well, actually, it's right down here at the bottom. Even though we were looking at the commercial population, we wanted to get a size enough pool so that we could get a good understanding of what the cost and experience of those members for these particular DRGs were, because our intention was to apply the pilot, at least in the first year, under the employee program, because that, in our view, was the lowest risk population to do this on, because the system is already self-insured for this population. And and probably a lot of you feel the same way. My thought is, if you're ever going to try anything new, realizing that you got to learn before you really take it to the market where you have a lot of risk, is that use your system employee population to experiment on some of these payment models. It provides the lowest risk for both the system and for the health plan. That's just a membership slide, so we'll go past that. This was the age of the population. So as you look, unlike the cohorts with the Medicare population, which are more condensed, obviously you got a much wider band on the ages and the potential for different age groups here. Although it'd be somewhat more rare, obviously, to be doing joint replacement or hip replacements for children. You clearly can't rule that out, because there are obviously exceptions to that rule. But most of the adult population, you can see, skew toward over the age of 50. So let's get into cost by bundle. So this is kind of an interesting slide for you, in that, as you can see, and we'll contrast that this a little bit later on with the Medicare population. I have some statistics for you. So what you're trying to look at is you have your surgery, which is in orange, and then you have services that you provide 10 days before surgery. That's what was included in the bundle. 10 days before surgery, and then up to 90 days after surgery. So for the commercial population, and then we broke the cohorts on the 90-day and 30-day increments. Well, when we look at the cost, that big old orange just sticks out right in your face, because what we learned from looking at our costs with the commercial population is very little cost in pre or post surgery. And that's because the commercial population has far less complications or issues, because you're talking about people who are obviously of a younger age than the Medicare population. So that's how we broke it down. You can see for each category the average cost for each. And the surgery, obviously, is by far the largest. Very little pre-service costs, and very few post-service costs as well. This gives you a little bit of a schematic in looking at each category, the pre-surgery, post. Gives you a breakdown of both from the minimum standard deviation, 25th, 75th, maximum, just to give you an idea of what the maximum cost in each category was, and then where did the average cost reside. And again, outside of looking at, let's take the 10-day pre-surgery, for the most part, fairly tight band, right, between $80 to $264 in this first column, with the average being 321, which is driven by the fact that, and I don't know the particulars for whether this was one case or more than one case where we had a patient that actually had $9,000 in pre-service costs. So that kind of skewed the average a little bit. But you can see a fairly tight band. You go to the surgery itself, and the good news here is on the surgery side is very tight band in the actual performance of the procedure itself. So pretty predictable, obviously lends itself to being able to, in doing this bundle, that you're going to have fairly predictable costs.
Are these just electives or did you have fractures?
No, these are just electives. Yeah.
Just a second. Here you go.
Thanks, Mary. On the post-surgery phase, does that include rehab costs or is this just provider costs? It just seems exceptionally low to me, especially for the knees.
Yeah, yes, that just included provider costs.
Provider costs, okay. So it's not total cost of care then?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a more defined. All right, so, and then this is more of a histogram for you, meaning what the total bundle cost picture looks like, both for hips and knees. Again, what stood out to me for the most part, I mean, obviously you have a wide range there, but obviously a lot of activity, particularly for the takeaway here, particularly for the knees. These were a little bit more concentrated, even though the scatter diagram shows you a range here. Hips were a little bit more scattered out, but the knees were pretty consistent. Yeah.
Just got it right here. are you covering the, what if somebody went inpatient as a complication? Is that included in here, or is that, or not? Okay.
Thanks for handling that for me.
Yeah. This is surgery day cost, which enough said there from even the previous table. Very, very consistent for the most part. Post-surgery, interestingly enough, was consistent. I was a little bit surprised by this data. I would have thought that there might have been a few more examples of some complications that might have emerged. I guess what they told you is that with the candidates that the way they designed it, they had very few incidences of complications after the procedure. And as you can see, we had a lot. This was maybe a little bit surprising. Just how many at zero post-acute cost, had surgery at home, didn't really have any other issues after that. Implants, I wanted to show you a picture of the implants. Those also seem to be very concentrated around an average cost. Now, I would say, and again, don't know for those who have gotten into it, whether had troubles if you've gotten into this and getting your system to agree to focus on one vendor for the implants or maybe a choice of two vendors. I think that's where Scott White is still, they haven't done as good a job in this, I think. That's certainly one of the areas that, while this is not a real reflection of when we look across the system, one of the big pushes that the system has going forward is to get more aggressive in trying to get doctors aligned with convincing the choices, standardization of the implants that they use, not only just knees and hips, but other implant surgeries as well. They're a little bit more together in Central Texas, which should be surprising because of the group model practice. They're not all together in North Texas because people want to do their own thing. And hopefully, as they move forward, one of the learnings from this is that they really want the system wants to do a better job trying to get the doctors on board with that. This is just a table that shows you your implant costs. I do not know, the implant costs really were pretty tight, which was good to see. I don't know the reason, and I've made a note to call someone to find out, and you can get back to me, why you have that $33,000. It looked like, I think that was one patient. I don't know if they put the knee in, the knee broke, so they did another knee and charged it twice. But for the most part, the band is pretty tight on the implant when you look at it. Readmissions. Now, as you can see, there were a few things. I believe this might have been with the hips. As you look on here, there were some things that were excluded around the readmissions. And then there were others that were included that you can see here that they were looking at and putting together under. And while we haven't finalized it right now, this is an example of some readmissions, if they would occur, that would be calculated into the bundle. One of the patients had septicemia that fell outside the 90 days, so that was one example of a readmission that wouldn't be included in this particular DRG was carved out. Length of stay, not a whole lot to say there. Pretty tight when it came to it. You had a few cases that pushed out. I think one on there, we had 21 days, so we had some complications, but for the most part, I would say we didn't see any with the DRGs that was a concern around the facility having a problem if you want to stay around the DRG. These are all the facilities that we'd be focusing. Our effort on now, and the reason why Bumsey is the main hospital here in Baylor, but a lot of our commercial patients for a procedure like a knee procedure, even a hip procedure, would be scattered out around the Dallas market, so they don't get all of their procedures done at Bumsey. The one that in this particular, since it's our, if I had shown you the slide on our employee population, you'd see more Dallas hospitals on here because of the employee population that we're looking at doing. A lot of our commercial population right now is down in Central Texas, but clearly when we looked at, as we're looking at where we would focus the program, we'd be looking at the top four hospitals on the slide. Baylor Medical Center, Hillcrest, that's in Waco. We have a lot of population there. And College Station is to the south, almost directly east of Temple, maybe a little south. And then Temple facility is our largest facility that would be involved in the bundle program. So let's talk a little bit about progress today. So we came out of looking at all this data and we said, okay, let's apply this first to our employee population. Obviously, we're focusing around the orthopedic DRGs, 469, 470. We've done our research on the data. We're still sticking with the 10 days through 90 days, and there's nothing in the data today that points to the fact that's going to be problematic, because at least our data shows that, at least in the commercial population, there's not There's actually, for the most part, there aren't a lot of post-90-day costs, so there's not a lot of risk in that. We've also decided that when looking at this, that Central Texas, since it's more concentrated in the group model, there's more challenges in North Texas with this, that we're going to pilot it first in Central Texas before we move to North Texas. Just a little bit easier to get out and do. We decided not to include prescription drugs in the bundles. Hospital will assume all the provider risk for the cost and quality of care, but we'll create, they're working on risk sharing agreements right as part of this process with the providers that would be in the bundle. And that's easier to do for Central Texas than it is North Texas, because Central Texas, you're talking about employees, yes.
On the if a patient is discharged to skilled nursing, do you restrict the network of skilled nursing facilities, just your own skilled nursing facilities?
We do have sub-acute integration with our own skilled nursing facilities. There may be a couple that are independent that we may negotiate to participate in the bundle.
So they know they're in the bundle and it's specific facilities. Okay.
Part of the process around what performance or risk sharing measures will include will be also composite quality measures that go with it to ensure that we may have success with one, but we also want to make sure we're hitting our quality scores. Oops. So let me back up. So that's basically, let me end on this, and then if there's any other questions, I'll answer those, and then I'll want to spend a few minutes to get time on the pancreatic cancer program. But the benefits that we also hope to get out of this is obviously better nurse coordination. We have an ACO in the Baylor system. It's called the Quality Alliance, and we work side by side with them on the employee population that coordinate care. And so we're hopeful that we'll learn, one of the benefits from this is that we'll hopefully learn from our coordination with them that we'll get better nurse coordination around these patients being part of the bundle, and that we'll also improve the experience of the patient with that. We also are hoping that we'll get better risk screening standardization, so we assess the patient, making sure that the right patients are being assessed and put into the program. Increased patient interaction post surgery, because a lot of times what leads, and while our data didn't show that there were any problems, a lot of times where you went into your biggest problems is post surgery, and ensuring that, you know, the patient interactions, you're staying on top of that, so if there is a patient that has a complication or infection or something like that, we're on it before it gets too far. One of the things, and it doesn't necessarily relate to the joint bundle initiative here that we're looking at, but when we look at hospital data just for the Central Texas region, we see a lot of septicemia. And obviously, we're not totally sure what all drives that, whether it's, you know, how much of that's hospital-acquired conditions versus somebody not getting treatment when they should have got treatment, and they wait until they're really bad. But we do hope to see some benefits from that. The difference, with this being a commercial pilot, one of the big differences in how you construct the bundle payment is that in a Medicare bundle payment, you'd have about 21% or close to 21% of the total cost of the bundle built into the post-acute space of treatment, with about two-thirds of that related to skilled nursing, to get back to your point about the importance of skill. It's less important, even though we're including them, it's less important in the commercial population, because only about 80% of the cost of a bundle is reflected in post-acute care. A lot of that has to do with the age of the patient. And under that, only 4% relate to skilled care. So the skilled care, even the post-acute care, I think part of this is far less important in the commercial side as it is in the medical side.
I'm just trying to understand. So, and I'm not asking for competitive about how you're setting the pricing, but in terms of how that's included, obviously there's a, when you're talking about the types of groups that you're negotiating with, in terms of how are you going about establishing the formula for setting the price of the bundle, especially on the professional side of things?
So it goes into a black box.
You have one of those too, predictometers? I've got one.
We do have, and that was some of the stuff that I showed you on the histograms and experiences, all kind of claims data. We're also working with Milliman to help inform us a little bit with saying, okay, here's the experience that we see from our claims data regarding, and I didn't show you a complete breakout of professional versus hospital versus each of the provider units. I showed you more post-acute care, pre-care. But we are looking at our own data to inform ourselves what that looks like. And then from the scattergram of that, what does that show as the percentage of the total cost of the bundle that we're looking at? And then the other step that we're taking and looking at that analysis is to have Milliman look at that to say, okay, you've got a bigger population. Our cost is going to be different than what you're seeing, but as we look at the breakdown of services, do you see some of the same percentages? So if my cost in, an example that would be, if my cost, we say the total knee cost was $30,000, and 30% of the $30,000 was for the professional services, the surgeon and whatever else, then that would say we'd be devoting somewhere around $9,000 to $10,000 or $30,000 to that part of it. So what we're having Milliman do is to look and say, when you look at your database and you look at breakdown, does 30% seem right, or do you see experiences around the country where those percentages are dramatically different? So that gives us a little bit of a level set to say, is our own experience skewed? Does it seem reasonable relative to what they see in other geographic parts of the country as we try to develop the allocation? And then what the system will do, the hospital system and the physicians, they will sit down and then say, okay, as we look at these bundles, if this is right, then we're going to allocate that revenue over to the clinics, and then the clinics will disperse it to the physicians.
So they're at risk for, again, for any readmissions that would come in the hospital. That, have you had any discussions with the hospital? Because I've had these conversations with orthopedic surgeons. They believe they should get paid more for the bundle, and the hospital should take more of the risk because they're controlling the care. So if it was 30% in your example, they think they should get 35 to 40% because they're going to be managing it. Are you to that point in your discussions?
We started to touch on that, and it's more come up in if we perform well, so we're reducing costs, maybe we're standardizing processes, flows, we're reducing the complications or, you know, cases that may happen on the outer end of our experiences, then should we not get some type of performance or some reward for that? So we've kind of come at it in that direction, and I can't tell you where we landed on that yet because we still have ongoing discussions around it. The hospitals obviously are looking at it from their perspective and saying, okay, but if we're reducing costs and we play a role in that care, we need to get our fair share cut of that too. So I don't know where that's all going to land yet, but we are having that discussion.
One last question. What are you predicting in terms of savings for this particular pilot? Do you have some goals in that mindset?
Yes. I'm hoping, I think in one of the histogram slides I showed you, I think our average cost is somewhere around $45,000. So I'm hoping that we save at least a minimum of 10%. And I think if it gets done really well, and you improve and get everybody engaged, you have probably the opportunity to save 15 to 20 if everything goes right. But I'd be tickled pink if we got 10%. So if we reduce the cost from, let's say, $45,000 down to about $40,000 or $39,000, I think that'd be a pretty good win. Anything else? Okay, looking at time here. All right, so we still have a little bit of time, unless everybody's ready to go get a drink right now. So this won't take long, but I wanted to give you, and I thought this would fit a little bit with the discussion. It's a different approach. I wouldn't say approach, it's a little bit of a hybrid, in that we're not trying to bundle pancreatic cancer. So I just want to be straightforward. That's a much more challenging disease to manage. But the research group at Baylor Scott & White with the oncologist have been studying pancreatic cancer and approached me at the health plan with the idea of taking an assessment program and using that to inform your ability to potentially identify candidates for that may be at risk for pancreatic cancer and identify them at an earlier state and use this assessment program as a way to do it and do that through what I would call somewhat of a bundle payment. So I wanted to walk through this with you real quick. It won't take a whole lot of time here. So current state, why the system is looking at it is pancreatic cancer is as an abysmal survival rate. And part of that is because you don't identify pancreatic cancer until usually it's late stage. So then once you've identified it, it usually spreads. You can't. You know, the survival rates are very low. It's gone up to be expected, I guess, built this third bullet point here, is expected to be the number two killer from a cancer standpoint the next 3 years. And so what Baylor is setting out to do is to say, how can we figure out a way maybe to identify patients sooner? And in particular, I don't know if we've got any doctors in the room, but that first word scares me there, pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. I don't know if I said that right, but called PDAC for short, that's the way I would say it, but makes up about 85% of those cancers, and the survival rate is about 8%, 5 years. This is another key fact, only 10 to 20% of patients are diagnosed at a stage that may give you a chance to cure. So they catch very few of these. The other thing that's interesting is up to 16% of these cancers happen with families that have a history of pancreatic cancer, and that's where some of the targeting may go on. And you already know it's one of the third leading cause of cancer. So what they're trying to do is come up with what they call a familial risk assessment program. So knowing that you may have an increased risk for pancreatic cancer because it resides somewhere in your family history, they set out to try to design a program that would detect pancreatic cancer at an earlier stage and could halt progression, have less morbidity, more favorable prognosis and outcomes. One of the interesting things about this, and I was actually impressed to hear this from the researchers, is that the pancreas, you can develop what they call pancreatic cysts that are a precursor to pancreatic cancer. And so if there is a way, obviously, to detect those cysts and identify those that may obviously go to cancer, you could have a more early detection, you could have a cure. So what they're hoping to do is transition patients who are presenting at a late stage, obviously to get them at an earlier stage and improve the survival rate, 5-year survival rate. And if you look at the underlying section here, their hope is that they would quadruple it, which is, I think, a pretty big goal. And today, so you're at 6.8%, or 6 to 8%, so their goal is to try to get that up to 20. So the assessment program would do genetic evaluation, education, support to patients at risk for developing because of personal history or family history. These are some of the components. I won't read through them all, but you can see this would be what would be in their assessment and how they would look at it. Here are some of the assumptions. Yeah, I found this interesting. And I did not know this, but it says this third bullet is very interesting to me. It takes approximately 20 years from the development of the first malignant cell to progress into metastatic late-stage disease. So I'm sitting there going, wow, people walk around for almost 20 years with potentially cancer or cancer cell in their body before it actually metastasizes and then gets detected. So I guess on the one hand, you can look at it and say, hey, that's a long time. So if you can move back the detection point, it would make sense that you could improve cure rates or survival rates. And obviously, there's a strong correlation to doing that. The other thing about this is connecting this to our customers and employers is that obviously early detection, better survival would provide economic benefit and improve quality of life for employees and families. So the cost of the program basically breaks down, look on the slide here, when they are looking at North Texas employees, there's 32,000, so the focus initially was on the North Texas, although I think we would expand it to Central Texas as well. But you have 32,000. There's about 6,400 over the age of 50. About 5% would be diagnosed as high risk, needing the initial screening. So that comes up to an N of 320. So when you just look at big populations like this, they would say, when we do our screening or get down to who would be at high risk, they think that the group would be a total of about 320 people. Those that will go on to be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer during their working years, which would be up to age 70, would be about 70 of the 320. So a total of about 1%, a little over 1% of the total population. We talked about the fact that only 20% of this population gets identified at an early stage. They're estimating, if their research proves out, that'll increase to 30%. So if you're detecting 20% today, and then they say that about 20% of the 20 survive for 5 years, they believe that if this program is effective, that they can get that up to 50% of the 30 now. So instead of detecting 20, you increase it to 30, and 50% of those will survive. This is interesting. Lifetime cost, and once you are diagnosed, whether it's at a late stage or early stage, really is not a whole lot different. You're going to spend about $250,000 to get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Underlying that, though, is small numbers when you start to dissect it down. And when you look at the pattern, while the average is $250,000, you might spend $1 million, or you might spend $150,000. So it's not a program that I'd be sitting here today saying you might have a chance to put this into a bundle payment program. It'd be way too difficult to do that. But I was impressed with what they are trying to do. And one of the other things that they hope to accomplish out of this is potentially get NIH funding, because today no one has really developed an early detection program. So they are walking along this path of saying, if we can prove this out, maybe we can get funding from NIH to support the work. This gives you a little bit of a breakdown of the cost. The initial assessment, so when you do that first assessment, costs about $4,000. And then any subsequent assessment for the patient would be about $2,000. So if you look at the baseline group and doing the initial assessment, you'd be investing in the employee population about $1.4 million. And then incremental costs over the next 10 years out in demand, following these patients and continuing to monitor and assess, would be another $3.6 million. So their hypothesis at this point is you spend about $4.6 million, and they've got their projection on the value of an employee per year. But if they're successful on it, they can provide an economic value to the employer for employee retention because of the better survival rates and that sort of thing, of about $2 million. So the net economic cost of the program to Baylor and the health plan would be about $1.6 million over the 10-year period. Breaks down to about $16.81. So on the surface, I think this may be my last slide. Let me double check it. I got another slide after this, but on the surface, the 1681 doesn't look that bad. And so I've talked to the physicians and the researchers and saying, well, if we can get approval from the corporate offices for the employee benefit plan, the health plan would be very supportive in looking into doing this, particularly if it can be linked in with the researchers getting funding for it, that it might be an interesting value or an interesting program to assess and see what is learned from it, because obviously pancreatic cancer is a very tough cancer to cure or even keep people alive once they're diagnosed. So the actual cost around doing it would be bundled. If you look at that, we take those assessment costs, put it into a first-year bundle and then subsequent bundles. But we're talking about taking the various work done by the imaging studies, by the oncologists, and the different pieces of it, and trying to unify that into one billing from the providers going to the health plan on the employee plan, so that the patient only has one copay instead of being multiple bills from multiple providers. So we're still working on how that would look, but that's another goal of the program is, okay, we come up with one bundle payment for the assessment. The providers get together, send one bill to the insurer so that the patient's just paying, let's say, a $50 copay or something, not getting dinged for a number of different services. So this would be the impact. If it works out, early detection, disease potential avoidance, if you can identify the pancreatic cyst earlier and cure it. And then, like I said, it provides opportunity to bundle price the what we call the assessment services. I don't think we're going to get to the point, maybe we would, that we'll learn something from this that would improve the treatment of those who do get diagnosed with cancer, that you might only cost the treatment, but that is something that would be yet to be learned. So these were our recommendations around putting that together. So I thought I'd just share that with you so people have another thought idea to go back to your systems who might have research opportunities that here's one effective way to work with the health plan.
Is there
going to
be a
microphone on?
Yes, there is. And I don't know all the details around it, but I just spoke with them about what they're going to do with the employee plan, but they do have that. And that would be part of their, hopefully, the research plan that they get with the NIA.
Other questions, or also I want to open up the conversation. Are there others in the room that are working on similar projects, similar approaches? You may be just getting started. You may have something to report, anything that you'd be willing to share. Others, Mike or Mark, do you have something you'd be willing to share on it?
Well, we were one of the fortunate hospitals in the CJR program that were. So the Orlando market is in the CJR market, so from a bundle payment perspective, we're deep in the middle of this as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think to the point of the question of how do you look at the savings, I mean, you know, I think that our thinking on it is that we allow the constituents to share in the savings somewhat based on the percentage of their participation, so that if the orthopods are in fact, you know, doing a good job to help manage it, they're increasing their professional fee proportionally.
Yeah, kind of gets at Corrine's comment. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else? Others? Anybody working in this space? I know several of you are, okay. Well, if not, Corrine.
We're talking to a group, but unfortunately, their idea of bundled payment is pay me the same as what you were paying me for all these things separately, and just have it be more efficient and put some administrative costs on you to try to figure out how to make this all work. So that's where I'm at.
Sounds like a good deal. Any others? All right. Excellent work today. How was today? First day. Good job.